From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Joan Didion about grief. Her new memoir chronicles the year that followed the death of her husband, John Gregory Dunn, from a heart attack, a year in which her daughter was gravely ill. The memoir ends as her daughter seems to be recovering, but after Didion completed the book, her daughter died. That was just a few weeks ago in late August. Yesterday, Didion's memoir was nominated for a National Book Award. Also, we talk with Martha Stewart about being a brand and about her 5 months in prison, which she requested to serve before her appeal in order to protect her brand. She has a new book called The Martha Rules. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Life changes fast. Life changes in the instant. You sit down to dinner, and life as you know it ends. Those are the first words of Joan Didion's new memoir, The Year of Magical Thinking. It's about the year following the death of her husband, the writer John Gregory Dunne. He died as they were sitting down to dinner on the night of December 30th, 2003. It was a heart attack. He was 71. Didion and Dunne had just come back from the hospital, where their daughter was in a coma, suffering from pneumonia and septic shock. While Didion's memoir chronicles her grief for her husband, it also describes her daughter's medical progress and setbacks. By the close of her book, Didion thought her daughter was recovering, but just a few weeks ago, in late August, she died from an abdominal infection. She was 39. Devastating is the way New York Times book critic Michiko Kakutani describes Didion's memoir. Didion's best-known books include Slouching Toward Bethlehem, Play It As It Lays, and A Book of Common Prayer. Let's start with a reading from The Year of Magical Thinking. It begins as Didion and her husband were beginning dinner in what turned out to be his final moments.
We sat down. My attention was on mixing the salad. John was talking, then he wasn't. At one point in the seconds or minute before he stopped talking, he had asked me if I had used single malt scotch for his second drink. I had said no, I used the same scotch I had used for his first drink. Good, he had said. I don't know why, but I don't think you should mix them. At another point in those seconds or that minute, he had been talking about why World War I was the critical event from which the entire rest of the 20th century flowed. I have no idea which subject we were on, the scotch or World War I, at the instant he stopped talking. I only remember looking up. His left hand was raised and he was slumped motionless. At first I thought he was making a failed joke, an attempt to make the difficulty of the day seem manageable. I remember saying, "Don't do that." When he did not respond, my first thought was that he had started to eat and choked. I remember trying to lift him far enough from the back of the chair to give him the Heimlich. I remember the sense of his weight as he fell forward, first against the table, then to the floor. In the kitchen by the phone, I had taped a card with the New York Presbyterian ambulance numbers. I had not taped the numbers by the phone because I anticipated a moment like this. I had taped the numbers by the phone in case someone in the building needed an ambulance. Someone else. I called one of the numbers. A dispatcher asked if he was breathing. I said, "Just come."
That's Joan Didion reading from her new memoir, The Year of Magical Thinking. Joan Didion, welcome to Fresh Air. And I just want to say at the top, very sorry about the loss of your husband and your daughter. This is a really beautifully written book, and I loved reading it, but I also hated reading it only in the sense that, you know, it makes me think not only of your losses, it makes me think of, you know, losses I may experience and losses. Do you know what it's...
You know, I had the sense when I was writing it that I wasn't writing it at all. It was like automatic writing. It was a very different kind of process. It was simply everything that I was on my mind just came out and got on the page. And that was kind of my intention, to keep it kind of raw, because I thought it occurred to me when I was doing a lot of reading about death and grief that nobody told you the raw part. And every one of us is going to face it sooner or later.
How do you think it affected your grieving to be chronicling it as it happened?
Well, it's the way I process everything is by writing it down. I don't actually process anything until I write it down. I mean, in terms of thinking, in terms of coming to terms with it. So it was kind of a necessary thing for me. I don't know that it would be for everybody. You have to actually probably be a writer to process that way.
After you called, 911, it took about 5 minutes for them to come. What did you
do? What did I do?
Yeah, what did you do in that 5 minutes?
I kept trying to wake him up. I mean, I kept trying to lift him. I kept trying to... I don't remember. I mean, I don't remember what I did. I didn't do anything. I mean, there was nothing. I remember calling downstairs and asking the doorman to come up, But actually, the ambulance was there almost immediately.
You had an autopsy done because you wanted to know, like, did he die that moment he stopped talking? Or
yes, I wanted to know when he died, if I could have kept him alive.
Were you feeling guilty that there was something you should have been able to do?
I think everybody who has somebody die in their family feels guilty. Because most of us think we should be omnipotent, that we should be able to control almost everything. You know, I mean, it's a delusion, but we do think that we should be able to keep those we love alive.
Did the autopsy put your mind at ease on that count?
It did. The autopsy was surprising to me because once I knew he'd had a heart attack, I assumed it was an arrhythmia of some kind, that he'd gone into ventricular fibrillation spontaneously or just because of an electrical malfunction. That wasn't the case. He died of coronary artery disease, which everybody had discounted because he had had it. He had had it in 1987, been treated for it. Everything looked fine. He would have annual tests, including an angiogram, and nothing ever showed. It was totally silent.
Your book is called The Year of Magical Thinking, and you realize at some point that you had been engaging in magical thinking that had to do with this genuine thought that maybe he'd come back, so you shouldn't throw out his shoes in case he needs them when he comes back. And
right, maybe I could, if I did the right things, he would come back. It's, you know, it's a form of, it's the way children think. A lot of people have told me that, who have lost a husband or child, that they engaged in it too.
Is there a point where you realized you stopped?
There was a point where I realized that I had been doing it. And yes, then I realized that then it gradually stopped. I don't think I'm doing it now.
You talk about how you didn't want to give away his shoes, for example, because if he came back, he needed them. Giving away
right.
clothes after someone dies is so hard. I mean, you have to decide with all their possessions, what are you going to keep? What are you going to give away to friends? What are you going to give to charity? What are you going to throw out? Was that a really horrible process?
I haven't done it. I just left everything. After I discovered that I couldn't give away the shoes, I just closed that door. Now, I haven't had to move or repaint the apartment or do anything that required me to do it. I think, I presume that it would be somewhat less painful now than it was in the first few months when I initially tried it. Because now I know he's dead in a way that I viscerally didn't know then. But I would just as soon let that door stay closed for a while, until I need to open it.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Joan Didion, and she's written a memoir about the year after her husband's death. It's called The Year of Magical Thinking. And her husband was the writer John Gregory Dunn. How much had you talked about death with your husband? And did you have those conversations about what to do if the other dies and what you'd
well,
want
he was
for
always
the survivor?
Trying to, he was always trying to have that conversation with me. And I would, in many ways, not have it because I thought I see now it was threatening to me, and I was afraid of it. But what I thought then was that it was just dwelling on things that weren't going to happen, or dwelling on things that we couldn't help, or, you know, and so he gave me any number of, he was always giving me, also, because he did have this streak of Irish morbidity, he was always talking about his funeral and giving me new lists of people who could or could not speak, because he was kind of volatile in his likes and dislikes. And, of course, at the key moment, I couldn't find any of those lists. I mean, they'd been changed so often anyway that it would have made no difference.
I want to quote something you write in your memoir, The Year of Magical Thinking. You write, "Marriage is memory. Marriage is time. Marriage is not only time, it is also paradoxically the denial of time. For 40 years, I saw myself through John's eyes. I did not age. This year, for the first time since I was 29, I saw myself through the eyes of others. This year, for the first time since I was 29, I realized that my image of myself was of someone significantly younger.
Right.
As writers, you both worked at home and you were with each other just about all the time. Did you have a sense of who you were outside of the marriage, who you were as a single Joan Didion as opposed to a Joan Didion and John Gregory Dunn as a unit?
Not really, no. The family was my unit, was kind of the way I, that was actually the way I wanted it. So it was kind of necessary to find my, you know, to refine myself. I hadn't particularly liked being single.
When you were younger, you mean?
When I was younger.
Were there parts of yourself that you kind of relied on him to do? I mean, you know what I mean?
All parts. I mean, people often said that he finished sentences for me. Well, he did, which meant that I just relied on him. He was between me and the world. He not only answered the telephone, he finished my sentences. He was the baffle between me and the world at large.
So how are you negotiating the world now that there isn't that baffle?
Well, it's like everything else. You learn to do it. I remember when I stopped smoking, it was very hard to know how to arrange to walk around as an adult person because I had been smoking at that point since I was 15. And this is kind of like relearning all of, I mean, you kind of just learn new. It's not difficult. It's just sort of lonely. It's sort of a bleak thing to do.
Are you comfortable being alone?
Yeah, I've always been comfortable being alone. So that is not the problem. Basically, one thing that everybody who has been in a close marriage and who is in the what everyone thinks when his or her spouse dies is it's the way in which you are struck at every moment with something you need to tell him.
Right. In that passage that I just quoted, you say that this was the first time, after his death was the first time, that you realized your image of yourself was of someone significantly younger.
Right.
I think I know exactly what you mean, but I'm going to ask you to elaborate on that anyways.
Well, you know, I mean, John saw me as, in a sense, I mean, he didn't really, but he gave the impression of seeing me as I had been when he met me or when he married me. Basically, it seemed to me that we were still grappling with the same questions and problems that we had been dealing with as very, you know, when we were 29, 30, 31. We were still doing the same things. We were still worried about the same things. We were the same people. So I didn't really think of myself as getting older.
My guest is Joan Didion. Her new memoir about grieving for her late husband, John Gregory Dunn, is called The Year of Magical Thinking. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Joan Didion, and her new book is a memoir called The Year of Magical Thinking. It's a memoir about the year following the sudden death from a heart attack of her husband, the writer John Gregory Dunn. Your husband died 5 days after your daughter had been hospitalized for pneumonia, and by the time he died, she had also gone into septic shock, basically a blood infection.
Yeah.
So you were dealing, you had just gotten back from the hospital visiting her when he died.
We had been seeing her in the hospital. Yeah, it could not be described as a visit, really, because she was unconscious.
She was in a coma.
But she was in an induced coma because she was on a ventilator. And they kept her under heavy sedation so that she wouldn't tear out the ventilator, which people tend to do when they find something going down their throats.
So you had to figure out how to tell her that her, when she came out of the coma, you had to figure out how to tell her that her father had died. Why did you want to even bring that up while she was fragile? Yeah.
Well, I didn't want to bring it up. It was the last thing I wanted to bring up. But the minute she saw me, I knew she would ask where her father was. And so I wasn't planning to see her. I thought that it would be good if, at the time when they lifted the sedation, if her husband were there, and she would be kind of in and out for a few days, the doctor said. And so she would absorb that her husband was there, and then she would probably go back to sleep. And she would be focused on they'd only been married 5 months. And so she would kind of focus on him and on their life together. And it wouldn't in the natural course of things maybe occur to her to ask how her father was. But if she saw me, that's the first question she would ask. Where is Daddy? So I hadn't planned to be there. I'd planned to stay away but I was in the hospital. I was out in the corridor when they lifted the sedation. And unfortunately, the nurse told her that I was out there. So then she wanted me to come in. So I did. And I told her, because the first thing she asked was, where's Daddy? So I told her, but because she was so sedated still, I mean, it took several days for the sedation really to lift. She didn't remember it that night when I came back.
And you had to tell her again?
I had to tell her again because she asked how he was, and so I explained that I said, you remember today I told you, et cetera. And I'd kind of emphasized the long history of cardiac. And she had apparently, and what she said to me was, when I said, remember this morning I told you he'd had a heart attack, and she said, yes, but how is he now? You see, she had absorbed she'd absorbed the problem, but she hadn't absorbed what happened, the outcome.
Your daughter got out of the hospital. She had several major setbacks, but at the end of your memoir, you think that she's on the verge of really resuming her life. In August, after you'd finished your memoir, your daughter died, and this was about a year and a half after your husband's death. She was 39.
Right, right.
You had just examined your grief over your husband so thoroughly in writing about it, and then it was time to grieve again. Now, with your husband, you understood the magical thinking that you were going through, this impossible belief that somehow he was going to come back, so you shouldn't even, like, throw out his clothes because he'd need them if he came back. Having examined your grief so carefully, were there little tricks that one plays on oneself when one's grieving that you couldn't even do anymore because you'd seen through it by writing your memoir?
Well, I didn't. You see, I haven't really started grieving yet.
For your daughter?
Right. I think I'm still in the shock phase. And right after John died, there was a long period before I was able to grieve because I was focused entirely on getting Quintana well. And I think that was, in a way, it was very good. Because by the time I was able to deal with it, I was dealing with it not quite as a crazy person, which I certainly would have been at the beginning.
You had to deal with one thing that is a very, I think, peculiar thing to have to deal with when you're grieving for the loss of a child. You had to figure out, well, did you have to rewrite or update your book? You know, your memoir had just been sent in.
Your daughter never crossed my
never crossed your mind to rewrite it.
No.
But why
it
not?
Was finished. Well, it was about a certain period of time after John died, and that period was over. I mean, if I were to do something about Quintana, which I have no thought of doing, it would be a different book. It would be a different, it would be a thing of its own. It wouldn't be about a marriage. This book is about a marriage.
Joan Didion's new memoir is called The Year of Magical Thinking. She'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air comes from NPR member stations and Barnes & Noble, featuring Bob and Melinda Blanchard's Live What You Love, Notes from an Unusual Life, available in stores and at bn.com. From audible.com, where you can download and listen to NPR programs like Fresh Air, in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers. audible.com/freshair. Additional support for NPR comes from 20th Century Fox Home Entertainment, presenting the epic adventure Kingdom of Heaven from the director of Gladiator and starring Orlando Bloom on DVD. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we talk more about grief with Joan Didion. And Martha Stewart tells us about her 5 months in prison, which she asked to serve immediately before her appeal to protect her brand. And we'll talk about what it's like to be a brand. Stewart has a new book called The Martha Rules. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with writer Joan Didion. Her new memoir is about grieving for her husband, the writer John Gregory Dunn. He died of a heart attack at the end of 2003, just after they had visited their daughter in the hospital, where she lay in a coma suffering from pneumonia and septic shock. Didion's daughter died of an infection just a few weeks ago in late August. Things like deaths and other tragedies tend to test people's faith if they have it, or get them to immerse themselves deeper into faith, or affirm their lack of faith, or have them change from one point of view to another. I don't know if you've ever had any faith, and if at all the deaths of your daughter and husband affected that.
No, the deaths of my daughter and husband did not affect it. Whether I had any faith is, I have a kind of faith, but it's not a conventional kind of faith. And as I said someplace in the book, that I believed in geology and in the Episcopal litany, but I believe in certain symbols, but I don't believe in them as literal truth. I believe in a poetic truth.
Do you have any, what is death to you? I mean, when you think about death, do you think of there being some kind of afterlife or just, you know, like a void or a soul or?
No, I don't believe in an afterlife. What is death to me? Death is ashes to ashes, dust to dust. Yeah, there's a continuum, which is a continuum of things, but I don't believe in it. I remember somebody once saying to me, the manager of a motel where I was staying, I was doing a piece in Oregon, and this motel manager had just come back from a funeral, and he said it was the most depressing thing he'd ever been to. He said, it's the coldest funeral I've ever been to. It was an Episcopalian funeral. Have you ever been to one? I said, yes, I had. And he said, they are so cold. And I said, how do you mean? And he said, if you can't believe you're going to heaven in your own body on a first name basis with everybody in your family, what's the point of dying? And I loved this. I mean, it was so far from any kind of church I knew, you know. I mean, the whole question, what's the point of dying? Well, yes, what is the point? I mean, there was a kind of madness about it. I mean, that's the faith I don't have.
Do you ever wish you did? Do you ever envy, like, that man, for instance, who has that kind of faith that, you know, he's going to die and be reunited in heaven
and that
in his clothes,
and
his body?
Yeah. Sure. That would be, I suppose, very comforting, but there's no possible way I could have it.
Are you feeling overwhelmed now by the fragility of life, having lost your daughter and husband?
Well, I certainly felt it after John died. Yes, I am a little on the wary side. When a friend was having a sort of a minor procedure today, and I was very anxious. I found myself being far more anxious about it than I might normally have been.
Are you any more or less worried about your own death now?
No, I'm not worried about my own death. I think I'm less worried.
Why?
One of the things that worries us about dying always is we think we're afraid we're leaving people behind, and they won't be able to take care of themselves. We have to take care of them. But in fact, you see, I'm not leaving anybody behind. This is an area we shouldn't get into, I think.
That's fine. Do you want another minute before we talk more?
Yes.
Yeah. We're listening to the conversation I recorded yesterday with Joan Didion. While we paused for a moment, my producer told me that this year's National Book Award nominees had just been announced. Then we continued the interview. While you were just collecting your thoughts for a second, my producer just came in and said, and I don't know if you know this or not, but it just came across the wire that your memoir was nominated for a National Book Award.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, well, great.
So I guess let me be the first to congratulate you.
Well, thank you. Thank you.
What a weird time for you. The book, yeah. I understand, is like flying off the shelves. It's nominated for a National Book Award, and it's about the worst thing that's ever happened to you in your life.
Yeah. There is a mixed feeling about it, I mean, in my mind. On the other hand, it would make John happy.
Oh,
I mean, I think he'd be very gratified.
I know that among other things, your book will be read by a lot of people who have, you know, gone through their own grief. What were some of the things that you've read that you found helpful? You know, one of the things that really surprised me actually in your book is that you sing a lot of Emily Post. You went back
Emily
to
Post,
yeah.
Emily Post was fantastic. on the whole subject of death and how to handle people who are who are grieving. I mean, she's so practical. She simply dealt with what happens to them physiologically. They're cold. They're going to be cold. They're going to need, their digestion is going to stop. Everything stops. Everything in your body just stops when you're going through something like that. And so she suggested little ways to get them back to life. Have them sit by the fire. The room should be sunny. They can be served small amounts of toast or something they like, but not much because they will reject it. You can sort of, if you just hand them something when they come home from the funeral, you will find that they eat it, but if you ask them, they will say no. Actually, Knopf got a letter from her, from one of her descendants who now edits the cookbook or the etiquette book, and she pointed out that the 1922 edition, which is the edition I was reading, had been written not long after the death of Emily Poe's son. And almost everybody in that period had somebody die close to them. I mean, we were dealing with the aftermath of the 1918 flu epidemic. People died of infections. I mean, death was really in every household. So it was a much more commonly acknowledged thing than it is now. I mean, now when it happens in hospitals, we tend to think of it as the province of doctors. Well, at that time, everybody knew somebody who was in mourning.
Before we say goodbye, I'm just wondering, I felt a little uncomfortable during this interview only because, the memoir is such a fine book, and I think you're losses are still so recent, I feel awkward talking with you about them. And I imagine it must be awkward for you to be talking about it to people you don't know, like me, and to our listeners. At the same time, I understand that there might be some comfort in that, because one of the things you've always been as a writer is a reporter, not a reporter in the conventional sense, but as a more poetic form of reporter who observes the things around you in the world and reports on that for the rest of us. Do you feel like that's what you're doing now?
Well, I think I had a very definite sense of reporting when I was doing this book, and I don't mean reporting, doing the research. There was a certain amount of research I did. I mean, I did some reading about grief. I mean, I read all the psychiatrists. A sense of reporting from a different, from a state that not everybody had yet entered. I mean, or that some people had but hadn't reported back. So I thought there might be some use in reporting back, in sending a dispatch, in filing.
Well, Joan Didion, I'm glad that you decided to actually write this book. And I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Joan Didion's new memoir is called The Year of Magical Thinking. You can read an excerpt on our website, freshair.npr.org. Coming up, a conversation with Martha Stewart. This is Fresh Air. Since her release from Alderson Federal Prison on March 4th, Martha Stewart's lifestyle empire has continued to grow. She has two new TV shows, is launching a satellite radio channel, and has a new licensing deal that will put her brand on a subdivision of homes in North Carolina to be called KB Home Twin Lakes, homes created with Martha Stewart. The occasion for our interview was her new book, called the Martha Stewart Rules, 10 Essentials for Achieving Success as You Start, Build, or Manage a Business. Martha Stewart, welcome to Fresh Air. This will sound like a really silly question, but with all the projects that you have to deal with and all of the decisions you have to make, does prison seem relatively relaxing by comparison looking back?
I'm really over prison. I can think about it privately, but to talk about it day in and day out is more tiresome than I wish. I am on with my life. I'm free. I am working. I am thriving. I am helping revitalize our company. I am writing books again, writing my columns again, and I feel really, really good. I'm glad to be home, and I am glad to be free.
I know you're over prison, but I'd still like to ask you a couple of questions about it. Would you describe a little bit about what the facility was like, what your surroundings were like?
I was in what probably can be described as as pleasant as possible for a federal detention facility. And it was not as bad as anyone could imagine. It was not unsafe. I did not feel in danger.
You know, there were so many jokes that were made about how Martha Stewart's going to redecorate her jail cell and everything. Did you do anything to make your surroundings more pleasant?
Terry, there are no materials to work with in a place like Alderson. You are not allowed to receive paper, decorative paper. You're not allowed to receive anything made out of fabric. You're not really allowed to receive anything other than letters and a certain number of photographs on a daily basis and a certain number of books. So if one could decorate one's room with 5 books and some writing paper and some colored pens that you could buy at the commissary, then you could do some decorating. But it was very impossible to do anything like that. And I didn't want to spend my time doing that. I read a lot. I had a fantastic opportunity to do a lot of reading, a lot of thinking.
What did you read?
Oh, I read many books. I read Durr's Encyclopedia of Trees because I was really interested in learning a lot about deciduous and evergreen trees. So I had the encyclopedia sent down to me, D-I-R-R. And it was fantastic. I mean, when do you get a chance to read an encyclopedia of trees? I've used it as a reference work, but I actually got to know the shapes of trees. I'm now very much better at identifying all kinds of trees. I also did that for shrubs. Let me see. I read Bob Dylan's autobiography, which was wonderful. I read many novels that I wouldn't have had time to read. Well, and, you know, I read and read and read and read.
And was it clean inside?
Cleanliness is one of the chores, one of the requirements.
So you mean you had to clean? Is that what you're saying?
We had no housekeepers, Terry. We are the housekeepers, Terry.
Is it in spite of all of your domestic understanding, is this a kind of cleaning you were not used to?
See, you don't know me very well. I'm an inveterate cleaner. One of my favorite things to do is vacuum, dust, wash, polish, scrub, clean. So I was really good at it.
Now, your new book is Tips for Starting a Business, which leads me to the basic paradox that some people think your success represents. You're an incredibly powerful and wealthy businesswoman. And in that sense, you represent the achievements women have been able to make since the women's movement. But your success is built on speaking to women's traditional domestic roles, cooking, decorating, arts and crafts. And it's exactly the type of stuff that a lot of powerful women who have succeeded in business don't even have time for. Have you thought a lot about that contradiction?
Yeah, and it is a paradox, and it is worrisome to some people. What I've tried to do and what our company tries to do, and I think our readers and our viewers and our customers really do understand that the domestic arts are just that. They are not drudgery. They are not something to be maligned. They are not something to be to look down upon. The domestic arts should be celebrated. And I discovered this a long time ago. My mother celebrated the domestic arts. She treated sewing our clothes as an art form, as something, as an achievement. She was a teacher. She taught sixth grade her entire life. After she retired from the Nutley Public School, she then went on to substitute teach up in Weston, Connecticut. And she still is teaching children at 91 years of age. She still sews for my friends. She has kept her hobbies, and she treated sewing. She treated that as a hobby, not as a chore. And if you have six kids to sew clothes for, it could be considered a chore, a drudgery, but not for my mother. And I think that that really, her attitude towards homekeeping really caused me to think a lot about why I grew up liking what other people considered chores.
Early in your career, you were doing some modeling for products like Breck, Tarryton cigarettes, Lifebuoy soap, Clairol shampoo. What kind of ads were they? Were they print ads, TV ads?
Both. I did during high school. I started in high school, I think, when I was about 13 years old, traveling to New York on Saturdays and doing live modeling at a store called Bonwit Teller. And then I joined a formal agency, and I was in Mademoiselle magazine and Glamour magazine, and I did a lot of TV commercials. Those were very lucrative, and they really did pay for college.
Would I remember any of those commercials?
Well, we've shown a Lifebuoy soap commercial recently on my show, and it's hysterical because there I am. I think I was 15 years old. I'm playing a married woman jumping off a ladder. And it was about antiperspirant soap. And the Tarryton was I'd rather fight than switch. Remember those?
Sure do. Yeah, with the black eye.
I had a black eye. It was very elegant, and I practiced smoking. I never smoked a day in my life, and I practiced for 2 weeks. My agent said, you better just learn how to inhale. At that time, I think I was 19 and married, so I practiced, and then they just made me hold the cigarette. I never even had to smoke on air, on tape.
So that modeling must be a good experience for what you had to do when you started.
Oh, it was fantastic.
The company,
who knew?
Right, because you've ended up on the cover of so many of your own publications.
Oh, my magazines and others, and whoever would have guessed.
Right.
But it gave me a certain self-confidence that a lot of young women lack. It made me certainly know how to stand in front of a camera and change my pose every 3 seconds as they, you know, click the shutter. And it was very, very good experience.
In your book, you recommend that people starting their business might consider becoming the face of their brand. And as you pointed out, it worked for Ralph Lauren, for Donna Karan, for Sean Combs, for Oprah, and of course, for you. At what point in your business life did you realize that you wanted your brand to be you? You wanted to be the face and the name of it?
Well, I think that was made very clear to me when I presented a prototype to Cy Newhouse of Condé Nast Magazines. Cy is the owner of Condé Nast. He's a wonderful, wonderful entrepreneurial genius in the media world. And he looked at my magazine, the prototype that I had created, and it was called Martha Stewart Living. And he said, Martha, I love the prototype. He actually had funded it. I love what's inside. But if you look at our magazines, it's Condé Nast Vogue. It's Condé Nast Traveler. I can't put Martha Stewart Living. It has to be Condé Nast Living. And I thought at that moment, well, if Cy Newhouse has Condé Nast and that is his, then why can't I have Martha Stewart Living? And I think that that's when it happened to me, that I realized that ownership might actually be wonderful. Ownership, having my name on a cover of a magazine, might show my readers that I am really involved.
What's the downside of having the brand be you?
Well, there wasn't any apparent downside until I had a legal problem.
Right, and the brand was in prison for a while.
And yeah, and the brand, which should not in any, I mean, the brand and the company had nothing to do with my problem, but I had something to do with my problem, and this person who was having a problem had the same name as the brand and the same face. And that's when the oddity happens. I mean, you know, you can't really even anticipate that it would happen to anybody else. But, you know, not to mention any names, there are other people who are the faces and the names of their brands, and it could happen conceivably to them. And I hope it never does, because it's horrible.
My guest is Martha Stewart. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Martha Stewart, and her new book is called The Martha Rules, 10 Essentials for Achieving Success as You Start, Build, or Manage a Business. Because you're such a successful, powerful, and wealthy business and media figure, you're both an icon and a figure of mockery. By figure of mockery, I mean you're caricatured on Saturday Night Live. There's all kinds of like internet Martha Stewart parodies. There's Martha Stewart book parodies. The late night talk show hosts make jokes about Martha Stewart. What does it do to your ego to be both, you know, to be the icon and the figure of fun?
Well, lately I've been spending a lot of time sort of scratching my head wondering what the heck is really going on here. And I think that the last 5 months has really helped me sort of focus on some of the problems inherent in being both parodied and admired. What we do at our company, and I hope that people are listening and understand now, what we do is teach. What we do is provide really good information. The people who work with me and I are really proud of what we do. I mean, I don't make fun of my teachers. I was brought up to respect my teachers and to like my teachers. And if the teacher said, Martha, you're doing that wrong, and I would go home and complain, my parents would say, Martha, the teacher's right. And I would go back and say, okay, teacher, you're right. I'm wrong. Let's get on with the project. Really, that's how I was brought up. And when my daughter complained about her teachers, I said the same thing to her. And she'd get mad at me. I mean, she would get mad at me. But I would support what the teacher was doing. So to constantly parody and make fun of teaching is kind of strange to me.
I want to read you something that our critic at large, John Powers, wrote in his book, Sore Winners. He has a short chapter about you. And some of it focuses on some of the paradoxes in your life and career. He also writes, her landmark deal with Kmart was a turning point in popularizing modern American design culture. She helped liberate millions from the tyranny of truly ill-conceived goods, low thread count towels, day glow colored ceramics that had been one of the most depressing features of not having much money. Her way of changing mass taste made her a far more culturally significant figure than, say, Eminem, Martin Scorsese, any dozen novelists you might choose to name. What do you think?
I think he understands what I'm trying to do, and I thank him very much. I think that I was the first, if you call me a designer or lifestyle expert, to take the mass market and improve it.
What's your legal status now? You're appealing, yes?
We are appealing. We have not heard from the court, and I... you know, I'm just waiting. It's a very, very difficult thing to think about, and I think that I had an unfair trial, and I certainly would like to win my appeal. It would solve a lot of problems, but we have to wait and see.
But you've already served your time, right?
Oh, well, I did. I made the decision to get over the really big obstacle, because without having gone to prison, I would be appealing and still waiting. That would have been an untenable situation to be in as a business person. Martha Stewart Living would not have two television shows on the air. We would not probably have the advertiser growth that we've had in the last 7 or 8 months. We would probably be suffering and suffering and suffering.
Do you know anybody else who's gone to prison before an appeal, who's voluntarily served the sentence before an appeal?
You know, I do not know, but I'm not an expert in that. It was a decision that I made knowing that it would solve a problem. It was a business decision. It was one of those calculated risks that I talk about in one of my chapters in my new book. And taking a calculated risk like that actually has solved a major problem, several major problems.
Well, Martha Stewart, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thanks.
Martha Stewart's new book is called The Martha Stewart Rules. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shurrock, Monique Nazareth, Ian Chilog, Patty Leswing, Sam Brigger, Joan Tui Westman, and Mike and Scott. Henry Baldonado directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art. From the Alzheimer's Association, advancing research, providing care and support services, and promoting healthy brains at alz.org. And from 20th Century Fox Home Entertainment, presenting the epic adventure Kingdom of Heaven from the director of Gladiator and starring Orlando Bloom on DVD. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
George Clooney's new film, Good Night and Good Luck, tells the story of Edward R. Murrow's CBS broadcasts challenging the tactics of Senator Joe McCarthy. On the next Fresh Air, Bob Edwards talks about his biography of Murrow. Join us for the next Fresh Air.